Good afternoon, and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson, and you're listening to WDRT Community Radio 91.9 FM and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org. And you can go to that website and look under the archives and find many podcasts now, my show and other, especially the locally produced shows, those you can get on podcasts now. And I was trying to listen to WDRT the other day, and I was on my way to Richland Center and got to about Boaz, and it cut out. So I realized we still don't really have a very long signal. But you can always listen to WDRT live streaming at noon on Saturdays, or the next week, look up the archive. So today I'm talking with Lars Bergen, and I want to welcome Lars. He's from Westby, and he's a farmer and an entrepreneur and very creative person and is interested in almost everything. That's why I keep having him on my show. So welcome, Lars.
Thanks for having me, Philothea.
Yeah, great. We're going to talk about something that he kind of recently, I think, got interested in, and that's mushrooms and the whole area of fungi and, you know, not only for fun, but, you know, I don't know, maybe beyond as a business? I don't know. But we're going to talk about mushrooms during this hour, and so we're just going to get started. What made you, is this a current interest, or have you been interested for a long time?
Well, most of us, or not a lot of us in the Cooley region, Driftless region here, spend a little time hunting mushrooms in around this time of year, right? Because mm-hmm. the morel mushroom is so delicious and so elusive.
And it's very recognizable, so you know right. you're not going to get right. a poisonous mushroom. So,
but the past few years, inspired by my wife Karina and my little boy Henry, we spent a lot more time in our woods looking for other mushrooms too. Like, and there's several edibles that are really safe and easy to find too. Golden oyster, which is a new entrant to our mushroom world, came from somewhere else, but pheasant back, chanterelles, shrimp of the woods, entelomas. There's a bunch of them, and there's a season for each, and we just got into the habit of going to find mushrooms. And then as in my day job, I sell wood recycling machines. And wood recycling machines essentially grind up pallets or trees or whatever to make mulch or other ground products that people then can use. And visiting these mulch yards, which would often have like these big piles of decked up logs or big piles of mulch waiting to be sold, you'd notice a lot of mushroom activity in those log piles or in those mulch piles. And so it just got me thinking about how this kingdom of fungi could be used to help feed people, help break down these big piles of carbon that occur in both on farms and also in wood recycling situations. And then there was a certain amount of like buzz around mushrooms coming that you hear, like the role in breaking down toxins, consuming plastics, all the stuff that was like being tried on tiny micro scales. But so I just thought last year we started just trying to establish a bunch more species of edible mushrooms on our farm.
I'd like to learn more about that. Okay.
So the one that I had known about growing and we had done before is the shiitake mushroom. You probably had those or heard of them, right? Mm-hmm. Japanese. And they've been cultivating in Japan for centuries. And the standard way of cultivating those is to drill holes in a log and then you inject either a little bit of sawdust spawn in there or a little wooden dowel that's impregnated with the mycelium. And then it'll grow throughout the log and then it'll fruit, you know, for years. And there's ways of making it fruit faster or slower, like soaking it or, and you, and
Can you do that inside or outside or both?
Well, that's a great question, because my attitude or my experience of farming and kind of life on Earth right now is that people are on a really big control trip, like controlling processes, controlling nature, controlling each other, controlling viruses, you know? I mean, just like it's... And the mushroom world, the way mushrooms that you would buy at the store are generally produced is a very controlled situation. They're sterile. They create indoor environments where you really mimic the woods on a cloudy day. And because the thing about mushrooms when they're fruiting is they really need a lot of moisture to get a good fruit. And that's a really difficult thing to recreate outdoors, right? Whereas
yeah, it's hit or miss.
But it's also not that easy of a thing to create indoors. I mean, it's expensive to create a big enough room that you can get to like 80, 85, 90% humidity and keep it there without it, the room molding or getting a bunch of specialized equipment. And
right.
So what we've been trying to do, well, sorry, the answer to the question with shiitakes is it's all been outdoors for us. I mean, and which means that you have a shorter season because obviously they're not going to fruit when they're dead frozen, but they will. Freezing doesn't kill mycelium networks. It just kind of puts them into dormancy and then they'll wake up again in the spring. Just like a lot of your, what we would know, most of us are much more familiar with the plant kingdom than the fungi kingdom. So it's interesting to understand it. There's certain similarities between plants and fungi and then certain big differences. So with a plant, generally, there's two main ways that plants kind of reproduce themselves, right? There's a seed, it's a sexual reproduction of where, you know, pollen.
Male and female.
Yep. You get a seed and it's usually an annual-ish process. Oh, sorry. And it's very in tune with the length of the day and the seasons and all that. But then there's also plants that grow underground, like ferns or aspen trees or whatever, where they send out a network and then they put another shoot up, which is genetically identical to what. And so what I know about mushroom, the life cycle, is basically you have, you know, the seed is what's called a spore. Right, and that's generally, if you've had mushrooms around and you put them on a piece of paper, they'll leave spores on the paper, spore print, and then
yeah, like tiny little dots.
Tiny little dots, or then and different colors, different textures, depending on the mushroom. Then the spore can be the seed or the beginning of a mycelial network, where it'll go into a substrate. Substrates being like its home, you know, what it eats on and lives on. And then it creates a network, which usually looks white if you're looking at like the end of a log or in a you know, a pile of sawdust or whatever. Not always, but there's
your basement wall.
Right, totally. And so then that when that mycelium network reaches usually, you know, the end of its food in the substrate, it'll then start making a fruit, and the fruit is what we call a mushroom, right?
Okay.
But that's just the what's in the world of mushroom people. It's known as the fruiting body. You know, that's, and then the fruiting body will come, and usually quite not. It don't last very long in an edible or living form. They'll make the spores, and then they'll kind of deliquesce, right? They'll become mush and fall back down to earth, having thrown their spores. And how these spores are ejected or kind of spread is really varied from species to species. Like the ultimate in which there's no power used would be like puffball. You ever seen one of those?
Mm-hmm.
And you step on one and poof, it goes everywhere. It's super duper fine. And that's enough to spread it. But a lot of them actually have built into them like tiny kind of ejection seats that will shoot the spore.
Mm-hmm.
Out far enough to get away to, you know, you're like all beings, you know, fungus wish to colonize just like people do, just like every species wants to occupy more space than the last generation did. In learning to grow these things or help them grow on our farm, part of it's just been learning that and starting to observe how the ones in the woods are doing it already and where they're doing it. But you can, we chose not to really engage the process too much from spore to mycelium, because you can basically buy myceliated grain or sawdust from a bunch of different companies. The one that I use, because they're Wisconsin based and have always been reliable, is called Field and Forest. And they're pretty big. Like, you can go to the co-op here and they sell fruiting blocks from them. Anyway, they're super easy to work with, and they use speedy delivery, and it works pretty well. So what we did last year is I must have ordered a dozen different species, like a lot. And with the idea of we live in a very Amish neighborhood out there in Clinton Township, where almost every farm has a sawmill. So there's a ton of woody waste around, whether it's mulch or sawdust. And so we try to use those waste products to inculcate them or impregnate them with the stuff from Field and Forest and expand it that way. You know, the way that most mushroom production is done, again, is in very controlled ways, where you have a dark room with the right CO2 levels and the right everything to grow
temperature.
Mycelium, and then you move it to a fruiting room where you have light and oxygen and moisture, and we did that on a small scale, because I did feel like for me to understand this at all, I had to do some more controlled experiments. But basically what we did was put a lot of mushroom spawn out there into mulch piles. We mulched probably, I'd say, couple hundred feet of our logging roads with a foot deep of mulch, and then planted that to wine caps and Namico. There's some that are known as kind of doing well in natural settings and in mulch, so we went with those. But the species, and last year you do, like, I have, the way that I've learned best as a farmer is just by trying things. And so
you have to grow old doing it.
Right. And observing failure.
Yeah. Does it take more than 1 year? I mean, when you start with the mycelium, do you get a fruiting that year, or do you have to wait
a couple of seasons? And what, like, if you're controlling the process, like, and sterilizing the substrate and then controlling the whole thing, definitely no, it shouldn't take a year. Like, and I had success getting fruitings off of different things last year that were, if you're doing logs, absolutely, it'll take at least a year to get that log to a point where it'll give you a fruit. But with the sawdust, there's a lot of things you can do to kind of change that time horizon. You know, like, one is what's called nutrifying it, where you add more readily available calories, like either rye grains or corn syrup or hay or things that have nitrogen in them, easily accessible, that will make it grow faster.
Oh.
And fruit faster. You know, so like when they sell you a fruiting block from like Field and Forest, there'll be a certain amount of grain in there because that's what helps it like grow faster. Whereas if you're getting buying sawdust spawn to use to impregnate something else, then it'll be straight sawdust because you're not as focused on getting them to grow fast. But the ones that, so a bunch of them didn't really work that well, or we didn't like the way they tasted. So last year I fruited at least one block of everything just in my fruiting shed to see what it tasted like, to see if we liked it. And there were some that we really didn't dig that much, like chestnut. Really, really earthy, like to the point where, and also you learn when to pick them. And a lot of these mushrooms, you have to pick them earlier than what you think. Because, you know, as a gardener, there's always that temptation to like, oh, I'm gonna see how big it's going to get, right? And then eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ones that are most commonly grown, and you know, once you start doing it, you see why, are shiitake, mm-hmm. lion's mane. And then this wine cap one's really intriguing, and that's the one that we've had the most volunteer
success
with.
I've never even heard of them.
Should have brought some.
They grow in the wild here, or
a little bit, but mainly they're cultivated, but they do really well outside. So on Field and Forest, they had a little video about wine cap treatment of your mulch underneath your tomato plants. And I encourage someone to Google it up. It's fascinating. So they had four tomato plant plots. One wasn't mulched at all. One was mulched with straw. And then they had one mulched with wood mulch without mushrooms in it. And then they had a fourth one mulched with wood mulch that had wine cap spawn in it. And it was like in a beating sun garden situation, you know. And they were definitely watering. But the thing that was amazing was, first of all, the tomatoes that were planted with the wine caps produced 20 to 25% more tomatoes than the other things.
That was an unexpected result.
But, I mean, the way that... And they also got wine cap mushrooms as another byproduct mm-hmm. of doing that. Mm-hmm. So we definitely tried that. We probably had 30 or so tomato plants last year, and they all got mushroom mulch underneath them. And we had good tomato crop, but we usually do. So I wasn't using the scientific method really, and having some that I didn't do it with. Most of them got it. But the thing that was most intriguing was where we saw mushrooms, wine cap mushrooms pop up was in the yard next to the mulch. You know, like that, because the mulch does dry out faster than the ground. Like the yard has grass in it that's kind of keeping it wet. So
They traveled.
And I think it's like there's a lot of things about mushrooms, or like how mushrooms work, that are really interestingly similar to people. Like, you know, like what people love to do is change the environment, right? Like we like to make our environment comfortable for us. And mushrooms, in their world, they are competing with basically others, like bacteria mainly. And bacteria are independent units, right? Independent cells, whereas a mushroom is a network. And a network grows slower than an independent cell could act. So if you take like a compost pile, generally the bacteria are going to outcompete the mushrooms or the mycelium. But the way the mushrooms handle that problem is that they all make a natural antibiotic that creates a zone around where they're working that makes it less hospitable to bacteria. And that's why, and again, the phones will ring with people saying this isn't true, but I'm pretty sure it is. Like, almost all of the antibiotics known to man, including the ones that everyone knows, like penicillin, ivermectin, were all made by yeast or mushrooms. All of them.
Oh, right.
Because that's how they work mm-hmm. in their world, to terraform, to create an environment. Mm-hmm. And the other thing they do is they break down, they put out, you know, the way we have digestive enzymes in our stomach and in our mouth, because we do our digestion inside of our body, as mammals do. They do their digestion in some ways outside of the network, and they put out these chemicals and things to break down the material before the network grows through it. And so that's why they're useful to nature and to people in breaking down things that don't break down that easy always, is because they, again, their digestion is happening kind of in the environment. So they're digesting that stuff
ahead
of themselves. Isn't it?
It really, really is. I'm going to just take a little break. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM, Dirt Radio, WDRT, radio from the ground up. And I am talking with Lars Bergen about mushrooms. You might have wondered, what are they talking about? Because we kind of got into, you know, some terminology that you might not recognize. But how interesting. Yes, out of the fungi world come antibiotics.
Totally.
That is one effect that they have.
Yeah, I mean, the story of how he found penicillin is kind of a well-known one. It was a mold growing on something by accident. Mm-hmm. And then he noticed that, like, the bacteria in that dish were dying. And then mm-hmm. he thought about it. And so that changed the world. Mm-hmm.
Just this story, Lars, you were talking about your son who's 8, I think. Mm-hmm. It's just a wonderful opportunity to do the scientific method. You were trying some here, some there, some in this kind of environment, some in that kind of environment, and this is actually what was done with penicillin, is, you know, looking and seeing and trying and having a thesis and then seeing, you know, where if it works out or it doesn't, and, you know, just having a double blind study and all these words that you hear in science. And you can do this with an elementary school child and just do it in your garden or do it, you know.
Right. And since, and the elementary school child's less likely to be bribed by the people that gave him the grant. So he's going to probably not put his thumb on the scale quite as often. So that's another matter. Right. But ivermectin was the other one that, like, everyone, every vet uses it, it's all around. And he discovered it in the soil as a Japanese guy. He won the Nobel Prize for, discovered it in the soil on a golf course somewhere. And somehow, I don't know the story as well with that one, like, kind of the aha moment of how he figured out that it was
parasitical, wasn't it? That was endoparasitical.
So... anyway, those are the two that I know about the best. But generally, I think the whole note, and most antibiotics are produced by some, you know, the two big kinds of things in the fungi kingdom are, you know, mushrooms that produce a fruiting body, like the ones we're talking about, mm-hmm. and then things more like yeasts, where they grow in a colony and they mm-hmm. they mm-hmm. still transform and consume, but they don't, like, there's no, like, yeast mushroom, right? They just keep growing as a colony. They don't make a network. They just add on to each other. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And again, that one, I definitely bake sourdough bread, and I understand them practically, but not, like, I don't know much more beyond what I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
But back to how people can grow mushrooms, or how we've been messing with mushrooms on our farm is we've been taking certain big areas that we know are going to stay wet.
You look at what kind of surroundings they're going to have.
And I've just gotten started. I mean, like, it's just there's not enough time in the day to try all these things, and then they need their time to unwind, because if you also have a hillside in the Triffus region, and one of the things that you're always aware of and attentive to is ditches, right? Like, how do you keep the ditches in your woods from opening up and getting bigger? And, you know, because erosion can really do that mm-hmm. if you get the wrong rain at the wrong time. And there's a guy from, I think Switzerland, but Europe, called Sepp Holzer, who advocates, he did a lot of mushroom growing, and even though he's quite high up altitude-wise, but one of the ways in which he did it was called hugo culture, where you take the low spots in your woods and you kind of make, like, a dam almost of logs and mulch or chips or whatever, and then put mushrooms in there.
That's what my ditches are doing.
Opening up.
They're filling up with the fallen trees.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean,
I can't even walk down there now. I have so many trees piled up, but that's what nature's doing, right?
Well, yeah. And you could.
Oh.
So if you have a strong young man around, I know, give him a chainsaw and get him to, like, organize that stuff, and then put some mulch on there that's got a little mycelium in it, and come back in a year and you almost certainly have something. And the other thing that's really fascinating about mushrooms in the way they influence materials is they firm them up. Like, they make them into a unit, like, that wasn't a unit before. And this is something I've only heard from a book, but I know that there are people making building materials using basically myceliated straw, or the certain mushrooms make things as hard as wood. I mean, you can actually see it in the woods. Like, a lot of the shelf mushrooms are harder than the wood they're growing on, you know? So that's actually a fruiting body, but the mycelial network can do the same thing, where, like, these, when I've made my own sawdust blocks, you put them in there as, like, loose sawdust, and then when it's run through, it's like, it's hard, you know, like,
yeah, because they have all these little threads, right?
Right. And there's then, this, yeah.
Yeah.
It's so, there's definitely like, there's a lot of research into using them to like, basically you can grow a wall. Like you take a form, pack it with straw that's got the right strain of mushroom in there, and that'll consume all the straw and leave something that's like kind of like, you know, foam insulation. Just like, you know, it's got, it's strong, it's airy, it's got a lot of R value.
Did they know that when they started these straw bale houses? Or is that something they found out happened? Because I thought they were just having straw forever, and then I thought, well, straw would break down, wouldn't it? But boy.
I think the straw can also, I mean, I think the straw bale houses, if it's properly dry, I don't think it has to break down, right? This is, these new building products are things that are made on purpose, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if the straw is kept dry and,
okay,
and
that would be a different thing.
Yeah, that'd be so, a different thing. Yeah. But straw is a really popular substrate for growing mushrooms, for sure. And
you were saying rye straw is better than oat straw. We were just talking about that.
That's based on other people's info because I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I did just try an oat straw experiment with Thoreau College this week, oat straw and oysters. Oh, and that's the other kind of mushroom that I haven't talked about, which is really everyone should know about because, yeah, the oyster mushroom is the most, I would say, like aggressive strain that you can grow pretty much. They're pretty wide in what they'll consume. They like to grow fast. So if someone is going to try and start, that is a good one to start with because it's nice to have a little success early on because there's the yellow oysters that, you know, you'll... If you go morel hunting right now, or even, yeah,
a little
right
bit
now,
later, or
yeah, well, you'll see often on this very same tree that you'll go, oh, there's a good dead elm, I'm going to go check it. And then you'll see, oh, it's that yellow thing on the tree, and it's a cluster of oyster mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely edible, absolutely delicious. And if the mushroom head is anything, I don't know, like there's different sizes, but if it gets close to the size of your hand, definitely pick it. And they're often smaller than that. And it's when you want to pick a mushroom when it's the edges are still curled down.
Mm-hmm.
As it's curling up, what it's doing is exposing its gills so it can shed its spores. But that's also kind of like the beginning of the rotting process. And you want to
kind of too late for eating.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. We've definitely pushed the envelope at our place in terms of how far you can go and drying them and stuff. And like, I mean, it's not going to hurt you. It's just kind of slimy, you know, at a certain point.
Mm-hmm. But mushrooms will dry.
Yeah.
So you
definitely
know, there's.
But you still want to dry them, pick them earlier in general.
Right.
Oh yeah, they dry great.
Yeah. So they don't just. So once you've picked a mushroom, it's not necessarily going to turn into mush like it does out in the woods and just disappears. But you have to dry. You have to have enough. You know, lack of moisture.
Yeah, you have to do things.
You have to do dehydrating.
Fast.
Yeah.
With certain parts of the process are slow. Like the running mycelium is slower than what you expect.
Mm-hmm.
But anything to do with the fruiting body has got to be fast.
Yeah, if you put them in a plastic bag in the refrigerator, they will dissolve.
And this, I'll tell you, Philothea, you know, I mean, I know you're always interested in how farmers can provide food and make a living. And one of the things that makes mushrooms such a positive thing for small farming is that because mushrooms, they keep so badly that they don't ship well at all. So, like, it doesn't scale up. You're not going to produce mushrooms in California and sell them in Wisconsin. Just not possible.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the mushroom, and I think the reason that when we talk about mushrooms, most people know one mushroom, right? What mushroom is that?
Morel.
No.
Oh, the white button mushroom.
Mushroom. And for different historical reasons, those are mainly grown in Pennsylvania. And they're shipped all over. And there's other mushrooms.
Pretty well, I must.
Yeah, they keep pretty well. But that's kind of like why we get them, right? That's the only mushroom just about that keeps that way.
I see. Yeah. So the ones we're getting at the co-op, they're all kind of locally grown, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Really locally. And then they still look old often the day after. You know, that just like it's. The whole like packaged food mentality of going to the store and always having the same thing there available just doesn't work that well for the mushroom thing. Like they fruit when they fruit. And then I think if I were doing this for like a business or a living, you'd probably want to work with restaurants, you know, because they can use up a bunch in a day when they have them, you know. And if people are flexible with you, that you could get, because then you're not worried about packaging them and keeping them cool. You know, like you just pick them and then take them to someone.
Right.
So the oysters that we have cultivated in our place are the Italian oyster, which is kind of known in the remediation business because they're often used to like break down like oil contaminated soils and stuff.
Really?
Absolutely. I went to a talk at one of the waste conferences I went to for work, and up by Wausau, there's a lot of sawmills, and a lot of those sawmills have a lot of like contamination of the soil from the years of like cutting oil, oil use and stuff. And so they, they exposed, they took a bunch of, they just made some boxes and laid out this contaminated soil and then put mushrooms in it, and they grew like crazy. And after a couple of months, they couldn't find those fluorocarbons, those oils in the soil at all anymore.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So, they oddly enough, in that test, they didn't test the mushroom, like, which would have been an important question for me. Like, can you eat this? I mean, they weren't going to eat them, so they didn't test them. But I think what's really fascinating is, did the mushroom break those compounds down beyond recognition and they're just gone? Or there's something else, right? So the other kind that we grew with great success and had a lot of fun with was the gray dove, which is kind of the most in the mushroom world, seems to be like the go-to most popular oyster to grow.
It's an oyster mushroom.
It's an oyster mushroom too.
They're
nice. I'll bring you some sometime. Okay. We'll have some this year, I'm sure.
Are they gray?
Yeah,
they're
grayish.
Not white. They're not white like a nice fresh.
Right, they're grayish.
White oyster.
But yeah, I'd say they're grayish blue.
Oh,
a
little, okay.
There's a like slightly blue cast to them. Uh-huh. But yeah, so those ones, we had the most luck with them getting things to happen fast in different substrates. And I'm still experimenting with like the right way to do it, you know, because the standard method of like keeping things clean and making them work is that they sell these polyethylene bags called fruiting bags, and they have on them like a filter patch that allows the mushrooms do need a certain amount of oxygen. They give off CO2 like we do. So if you totally hermetically seal them, well, they're gonna produce CO2 and there's nowhere for it to go, and they don't have fresh oxygen, so that won't work. You need some way of them exchanging gases with the environment, but you don't want them to be bringing in fresh spores to contaminate them. So these bags have a filter patch. It's maybe like 2 inches. Bag is like, let's say, 6 by 12 by 4, I'd say, or so. Anyway, or there's a bunch of different sizes, but these bags will take pressure cooking. So you can put your substrate in the bag, pressure cook it in there, to kill everything, let it cool, and then put your whatever mushroom spores you want. You can buy liquid spawn. There's a bunch of different ways of getting the spores, or you can collect them in the wild, culture them, and then put them in there. Anyway, and then you seal it up with a heat sealer. And so then it's completely closed to the environment. And then you put it in the dark and watch it, and then eventually it'll start turning a white network running throughout it, and then you'll move it to a place where it can fruit. And like last year, the way I always do things in my life is to get going a little bit too fast too early. Part of what I'm learning from the mushroom is to be more humble about my doings and how I do them, because they're like, yeah, because I was, you know, in wintertime, you're a farmer, you get a little twitchy, you get excited. And so I'm going to order like all these mushroom fruiting things from Field and Forest, and I'm like, get them to me as soon as you can. And so they show up in like 100 blocks. I mean, so that's like, it's a lot. I mean, each block, I mean, no one has enough fridges for 100 blocks. So all of a sudden you got like boxes and boxes of these mushrooms. It's frozen outside.
And you don't want them to freeze?
You don't? Well, it's not ideal. not ideal at all. And so anyway, last year we did a lot of things too early. And so I had to have a fruiting shed that was heated and humidified, and I made our well house work for that, and we definitely got a lot of mushrooms, but it wasn't an hourly responsibility, but it was definitely a daily one to like check on it. And you only have so many living beings you can check on.
Your mushroom chores.
Right, totally.
Wow.
But at the same time, Henry was really great at checking on them too, and we managed to get, and you know, Karina has always been super at the process of keeping, of like canning or, you know, drying or whatever. So any good farm project, you kind of have to start dividing responsibilities by what people are best at. And I've always been better at the production, and she's always been better at the keeping. So anyway, we got a lot of dried mushrooms out of the deal. And but this year, because I'm not so in a hurry, we're hoping to basically fruit everything outside. And we have like a little woods, like a lot of farms have, where you have that scrappy piece of woods, like that's not really part of the main woods, but it's got some trees and got some sumac and it's got some shade. And so we've got a lot of mushroom bags in there, and we actually did a project with the Thoreau College students on Thursday to start growing oysters in used 5-gallon buckets, because where we drilled holes in them and then we packed them with sterilized substrate and oyster spawn, and then put the lid on. And so with a 5-gallon bucket, you've got the whole environment, right? It'll keep the moisture in there. It's nice and big. And so, and then we drilled, I think like 40 holes per bucket, so that's enough air exchange for them to get oxygen in, and then they'll fruit out those holes. So there's a bunch of different ways to vessels in which to grow the mushrooms.
I've thought of a vessel.
What's that?
The plastic that all those hay bales and silage are wrapped in on fields, and all that plastic. Could we grow mushrooms in that?
Possible. I think you'd probably need it. I could imagine
you'd
doing
have to
something.
Pack 'em.
Well, or you need a structure for it to be. You know, like I could imagine making like a tomato cage and then wrapping it with that, you know, because you need some sort of structure for the plastic to be wrapped around. But that stuff is really a problem.
It is a problem. The people who tried to recycle that plastic just gave up. It's not clean. It's full of manure and gush and rotting vegetation, and it could be an environment for something. Maybe.
Yeah, no, I think that making that this building material piece would be interesting with that, where you pack it into a form and have something, and then all the contamination might be of benefit, right? Because it would be something for the mushrooms to get started eating before they have to start chewing on that plastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, in my work with the recycling world, that is, film plastic is very much an unsolved problem. You know,
well, they have talked about mushrooms consuming plastic, and I don't know if they mean in that quantity, but maybe you could actually grow mushrooms in the plastic, and that would be a good reuse of it.
Sure. I mean, what the plastic industry is specialized in is, of course, lying about their product, right? Like, plastic is recyclable. Well, actually, most of it gets burned at cement plants, but it's recyclable. It's theoretically recyclable, you know, and it's cheap and it's light and all this sort of thing. But like, basically,
it isn't really cheap. Somebody is paying for the manufacture of it and the disposal of it.
Right.
And so it isn't really cheap, and that's one of the problems of, you know, the economy of plastic.
Right. I mean, wasn't the whole thing about, like, for example, going from paper to plastic in grocery bags, like you're going to save a tree? Like, are you really? And what's the downstream effect of that plastic? And so plastic is a fascinating topic that I don't know as much about as I could, but I do know that like the plastic industry is specialized in proposing different recycling solutions that don't actually pan out, because it's a way of getting people to ignore the fact that there's just tons and tons and tons of plastic going to landfill every single day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we'll see. I don't, from what I have read and learned about this mushrooms eating plastic thing, is that mushrooms don't prefer to eat plastic, but they can be forced to. And like, that's certainly, you know, that's the way people have used breeding, you know, not GMO breeding, but like just basic, like picking the good one out of your herd or whatever. I think you probably, you would think you could train, you could sort of get the mycelium to genetically modify themselves, as if all they have to eat is plastic, or if it's 80% plastic. Obviously, the as they're going through their sexual reproduction process, the ones that eat plastic better in a plastic environment are gradually gonna, you know, win. And so I think it's
gradually might be the word there.
Right. And so
over a million years.
Right. Or a dozen years. I mean, I the basic, a lot of that plastic is baled, you know, for recycling or for landfilling or for whatever, just to keep, to get the air out of it, to like make it denser. And I think it would be intriguing to like put on, and you know, put spores in as you're baling it, you know, and then you probably have to drill some holes in the bales to like allow for air exchange. But I don't know who's into that. You know, it's, I've not been to one of those places. I know that it's talked about in the waste industry a lot right now, because mushrooms are kind of hot. And so we'll see. That wouldn't be, I don't know what I don't know. And it seems like it could work, but I know it's not a volume solution yet.
Now, you mentioned something just in passing, the sexual something. You said something sexual, right. And I thought, is there something sexual with mushrooms?
The,
where,
right,
the, is it male, it, female, pollinating? There's no pollinating. So where is the there still is a...
The spore creation process, the way I understand it, is a sexual reproductive process. But it's not... It's not between two mushrooms. I think the single... But it's really trippy thinking about mushrooms. I mean, it's just a very different way of seeing life, you know, because there's no brain. There's no, like, it's a distributed network, right, of energy. And how do they pass? The only one parts of the network that are generally, like, producing energy are the tips, where they're, like, they're into the... So how does that energy get passed back? Stuff is still... I'm still learning and observing. And there's good books. And we actually...
What are some sources that you can read?
Well, the person that's most famous, Paul Stamets, and he has a bunch of TED Talks and stuff, and he has one of the most amazing discussions of, you know, in the world of mushrooms, there's all these culinary mushrooms, but then there's also mushrooms that affect your mind, which are... being heavily researched right now for their... Michael Pollan wrote a book about them. Been proven super successful in treating depression, end-of-life anxiety, a bunch of things. Psilocybin mushrooms. There's 120 psilocybin species. So they're distributed throughout the world.
And well, that research was really kind of really suppressed.
Sure.
And now there's somehow a way of getting around this idea that they're dangerous drugs, but they might be things that you really need to know what you're doing. And but there hadn't been enough research.
Right.
Because we weren't even allowed to research.
Indeed. Like a chainsaw or a car, you need to know what you're doing. I mean, that's true of most useful and powerful tools, right?
A gun? I mean,
a gun. So anyway, Paul Stamets... was someone, he's got a big mushroom business. He's a professor. He's a mushroom guru. And he writes a lot of books. His books are a little daunting. I mean, he's a genius. He is freaking brilliant. And he has a factory and a team, you know? So like the way he does things is not necessarily the way someone who's going to start figuring it out on their farm is going to do it. But he tells a story that's so, in one of his talks about mushrooms, that he was like, he had a terrible stutter in high school. Debilitating, he described it as. And he took some psilocybin mushrooms and climbed up a tree. And he was up this tree, and a really gnarly thunderstorm came in and got scarier and scarier. And then there was a fantastic lightning strike that hit, like, the tree next to him and the loudest thunderclap ever. And he never stuttered again.
It's an unrepeatable experiment.
It is. There's no... Well, that's the thing about, like, the scientific method, right? Because for all of us humans, the main experiment we're doing is living. And there's no control group, right? Like, you're only, there's only one of you. And if you either, you go left or right, and there's no, you don't get to know what would have happened if you had gone right, because you went left.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. Hence, and I mean, you're a anthroposophist. You know anthroposophy.
I know something, and, a little,
right,
you
know, and
scratching,
you know,
that, the surface.
That the huge problem with the scientific method is the objectification of the world, right? Is like putting yourself separate from those things you're observing is actually false. It's scientifically false, and
it's
impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So the quote-unquote double-blind test is, it doesn't exist. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. But I mean, but it's the quote-unquote gold standard of medicine and stuff. So I mean, I get the notion, but
it's,
it also,
better than having no kind of comparison, or, you know, it's isn't it a step toward more understanding?
Less, because again, like if well, like if
precludes if, other ways of understanding.
Right, it precludes. It's a very non-intuitive way of working, mm-hmm. right? You know, mm-hmm. like, because there are people that make their way toward the truth just by going towards the truth, right? That's, and if you're not trying to sell the thing or convince everyone else to do it, then it becomes much less mm-hmm. necessary to like prove it. You just do it, and yeah, generally, if something you're doing works, people ask you about it and they follow it. And so, but that's a whole other big topic. And certainly in my mushroom studies, we should probably have a recipe too before this thing is all over, right?
Right.
It is Who's in the Kitchen after all.
Right.
But so
yeah,
far,
what
we've
do you
only
do
been running the pressure cooker.
Yeah. So what do you do with the mushrooms when you've harvested them?
Well, I mean, I think it's first nice to cook them as by themselves as simply as you can, just a few, so you can know what you've mm-hmm. got.
And what's the best way to cook them?
Well,
sort of dry in oil, butter, or
I like,
you know,
butter. I mean, I think
boil them. You don't boil mushrooms, do you?
There are certain mushrooms that you can, you know, like generally you can add some water. Like some of the tougher ones that really need to tenderize, I have like added water to cover them and boiled that off.
Oh, so can you do that with pheasant backs? You know, when they're getting kind of tough, I never thought about that.
Yeah, and with the pheasant backs, by the way, I should describe them so people know what they are. They grow almost always on dead elms, and they're pretty firm. They grow horizontal. You know, they grow horizontal.
Like a shelf.
Like a shelf. And if they're the size of your hand or smaller, they're usually quite delicious and edible, and they have a really fascinating aroma when cut, kind of like citrusy and floral. And then if it's at all hard to cut when you cut it, it's too far gone. You know, like, it should cut easy, like,
right, we did
like
cut
cheese.
Them all around the edges. We
right.
just did the edges. And when it got too hard to cut, then we
yeah.
didn't try to cook them.
Right. And then, but I have had success or being able to tenderize some by cooking them more. But at the same time, like, once you start getting in this mushroom thing and realizing there's almost always mushrooms out there to eat that are nice and easy to work with, you stop fighting it with the pheasant backs, right? You know, like, if you get them at the right time when their hand size are smaller, you cut them small. And of course, like, I'm a rotational grazing bee farmer, so I've gotten good at cooking all of the cuts of the cow. And what you realize is, like, the tougher it is, the smaller you cut it. You know, like, the if really little pieces of tough meat taste really tender because they're small. Like, same with mushrooms. So if it's kind of tough, cut it small. But I think salt and pepper and butter is a great way to
start. Sometimes a little flour.
Right.
I know a lot of people with morels, they'll dip them in egg and then flour.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
I
my
mean,
gosh.
That's
so
good. Yeah. Yeah, we did chanterelles that way.
Mm-hmm.
Chanterelles is a whole other topic because they're much, I think, an easier mushroom to find and know about, but also impossible to cultivate just about. All these mushrooms that grow in the soil require such a specific environment that people haven't been able to figure out.
Okay.
Things that grow on wood are easier to domesticate,
right,
because you can move the wood into your house or whatever. But stuff that grows on soil, there's dozens of factors that have to be right, and we don't know what those are.
I wondered, because we had a patch of chanterelles. Mm-hmm. They don't grow there anymore. We used to have boletas. They don't grow in there anymore. We don't hardly ever have morels. We used to have what we called coral mushrooms. They're kind of white. They look mm-hmm. like coral, and they're very easy to cook, and they're mm-hmm. delicious. They don't grow where they used to grow anymore. And so it's not only just conditions of the soil and moisture and heat, but it's like the climate is changing, and there's more shade, and there's more grass, or there's so many things to take into account.
And they're exhausting their environment. Right. Right? Like whatever it was that was feeding them there, they ate it up. And
moved on.
And moved on. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think if they're ones you know you like to have, I mean, we have at least three or four well-known chanterelle patches on our place that we revisit. Nice thing about chanterelles is once they start coming, they come for like 6 weeks.
And when's the time to look for them?
Dead of summer. Like late
summer.
June uh-huh. through early August mm-hmm. is when we found them.
Mm-hmm.
And again, also not grazing your woods, I think, is part of it. But you don't know, because you also notice like the decline of morels around here and the decline of people grazing their woods. It's a real mystery.
Then
you wonder, right? Like if that combination of disturbance and cow manure and a little bit of grazing down the understory might have been producing morel opportunity. Mm-hmm. Who knows? And the lack of fewer dead apple trees, because I think for like everyone talks about dead elms because that's what there's the most of, but dead apple trees are really productive if you have them. For mushrooms.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Like, and farmers used to plant whole orchards that would then kind of age out or die. And then, so life is full of mystery, Philothea. And I'm trying to only speak about things I know of and have observed. But so back to mushrooms. One thing that Karina really wanted to make sure that I mentioned is that to get the nutrition benefits of mushrooms, they do need to be cooked. They're a perfectly good source of like fiber as raw, but you have to cook them to get out of them what there is to be had, like the full mm-hmm. nutritional package, like mm-hmm. a lot of vegetables too. Mm-hmm. Like you can eat them raw, but they're not.
I know those button mushrooms that you get at the store, people slice them and put them in a salad. But
yeah,
most
but
mushrooms
think,
really, they're.
Yeah, and you,
they're
you can do
improved
that
by cooking.
Yes, and I think button mushrooms are too.
Yeah.
You know, or pickling is another way that is a uh-huh. kind of chemical way of cooking things.
How can mushrooms have fiber? That just seems amazing to me.
Well, that's what they mainly are, right?
Is that what they are? I don't know.
Right? I mean, it's, yeah.
Fiber is actually the structure of a plant.
Sure, it's a structure.
That's what holds it together, right?
Right.
So all these beautiful forms of mushrooms, they're different configurations of fiber.
In a sense, yeah.
Oh. And they like are really wonderful. If you look at a mushroom book or mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it's amazing. Who says there isn't a God? I just have to believe.
There's
a creator making one design after another. Oh, my gosh.
Or at least appreciating one design after another, right? You know, mm-hmm. like, I think that, yeah. God is definitely here to observe us and the mushrooms, right? And whether or not he or she made these things, like in that intentional way that we would make something, am I making these mushrooms as a farmer? Am I making the calf that came out 2 days ago? It's like, but you are the role of the observer in creation, of the loving observer, I think is really that's what I really try and, as a farmer, bring myself back to, because you can so easily get discouraged and like, oh, you're not getting all the jobs done. Oh, that's a mess. Oh, that broke. But
well, look at Genesis. Look at Genesis. God saw that it was good.
Exactly.
Each day of creation,
right.
He saw that it was good. I mean, what an insight.
This is the day that the Lord has made.
Let us rejoice and be glad in
right.
it.
Right. But a real quick recipe. So once you know what they taste like, a recipe that works for all mushrooms and is a great way of adding them in, especially if someone doesn't like mushrooms or whatever, like stroganoff. It's a classic mushroom dish, you know, like you, and the way I do my stroganoff real quick is you get some onions going in butter, put some thyme in there, put some salt and pepper in there, put the mushrooms in there, whatever you have. Can be oysters, can be button. Morels is kind of a waste because their flavors aren't as, they get kind of hidden. And then you basically, like, the mushrooms will release a little bit of moisture. And with that, you'll mix in some white wine and some sour cream. And then you'll have kind of like a halfway loose sauce. And then you'll put in nice small pieces of venison or beef and just cook that whole thing down until it thickens. And it is freaking delicious.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's simple. You don't have to take anything out. You have one pot. And you just be patient. And I find, like, no matter how tough your meat, if you put it into a liquid and grow slow with it, it's eventually, you know, it's braising. Mm-hmm. And it eventually tastes delicious. And that way you get the mushroom flavor throughout everything because you put them in earlier.
Yes, I was thinking, why wouldn't you put the mushrooms in after the meat? But you put the meat, uncooked meat, into this simmering thing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really
And mushrooms good. Are very, one thing that's great about them is they're incredibly forgiving about texture. Right, you can't overcook them. Like, they just don't.
They don't go away.
They don't get tough. They don't fall apart. They just stay.
Oh, and that's interesting.
If you want to get a special type finish, like a crisp or something, then you have to do something else to either dip them and fry them or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and if people want mushroom recipes, there's a guy from Minnesota called The Forager Chef who has a website that's freaking fantastic and has a lot of different options. Because he's specifically going after things in the woods, the recipes are tailored to things that you would find in the woods, not just button mushrooms from the store.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lars, I've been talking with Lars Bergen, and I'm just wondering, you are working with Thoreau College, but I'm wondering if you're sharing your knowledge, your searching of acquiring of knowledge with other organizations. You have a little club, or you do folk school or anything?
No, I am teaching a folk school class about rotational grazing
in
June, which I'm promoting right here on your show because I don't think it's full yet. And we have pigs and we have cows on the farm right now, and they'll both be part of the rotational grazing class. But no, I will someday be a master, Philothea. Hopefully, a masterful enough person to be doing that kind of thing. But mainly, I just come on your show, talk once in a while, and if people reach out, or I'm happy to also show them stuff. But at this point, I'm a student, not a teacher.
Oh, great! I just love having Lars on because we have gone from one topic to another, and he always links everything together. I've been talking with Lars Bergen from rural Westby and founder of many, many interesting things because he is a person that just is curious and he likes to start things and be a catalyst and so forth. So thanks for being on my show, Lars. I really appreciate it.
Been a delight. Thank you.
And you've been listening to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM and WDRT.org. This show airs every Saturday at noon, and on the last Saturday of the month is a show totally devoted to farming called Digging Deep, also at noon on Saturday. So tune in, and thanks for tuning in to this show.